Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned goods stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the Free Radicals podcast. I'm your host, Will.
I'm Robin. Hi.
This is episode 6, where we left off last week. Jan Matthys had been killed, so there's a leadership vacuum. And this story has a lot of hinge points, a lot of places where if little decisions had been made differently, the whole thing could have ended in entirely different ways. So this is one of them. Who's going to take over? What's going to happen next? How is this void going to be filled? There were plenty of times where the town council could have intervened to change things, where the local Catholic authorities could have established some sense of order, and none of the chaos that would come later would have happened. So this is that hinge point. We have the leader is dead. Their prophet is gone. He's outside the city walls. And a growing list of people who have left, who want their belongings and their people back, and are pressuring the Catholic bishop to take over. A lot could happen next. A lot is going to happen next. But things could change. On the inside, we don't really know what's going to happen. The bishop could take advantage of the lack of leadership and launch a full-scale attack. But he doesn't really have the money or the support from other Catholic authorities to make that happen. Bernard Rothman could reassert himself as the leader here. This is his movement that he largely started, but most of the people who've arrived from outside of Munster were loyal to Jan Matthys and his movement, and so it's not really Bernard Rothman's movement anymore. The group as a whole could lean on their sort of collectivist understanding, their community of goods way of doing things, and try to model for the rest of Europe how to run a city well. But rather than learning from this death, they leaned even further into the apocalyptic tendencies that incurred the wrath of the nearby bishop. We'll get into the more military developments and political developments a little bit later in the next episode, but I wanted to focus most of our time today on talking about the role of women within this whole movement.
That sounds fascinating.
So far, the vast majority of the figures that we've talked about have been men.
Very muchly so, yes.
Right. And partly that's just the nature of historians being male, telling male stories.
Of course, yeah.
And the way that history has worked with men largely being in power.
Mm-hmm.
But inside of the Anabaptist community and even outside of it, there are a number of women who had stories to tell, and some of their stories have been profiled within the scholarship lately. So I want to focus on those. And partly I've been saving those stories until now.
Mm.
So that's why they haven't been included as much. And one of the things that our listeners have said that they appreciate about the podcast is your role, Robin, as someone who advocates for the female perspective. So we're looking forward to that from you today.
Awesome. That sounds great.
You know, you grew up in a sort of patriarchal, socially isolated community. From your experience, what does it look like for women to have a voice in that setting?
Yeah, I think there is room for women to have voices there. I think there's just a lot goes behind how to have a voice, and a lot of thought goes into whose toes to not step on and how to word things, and what I'm going to use the word spirit in quotations, how you present something.
Mm-hmm.
women have to be very careful to present ideas in a way that is sort of meek and sort of humble and very, very careful.
Yeah, the role of women is complicated in this story, and we're going to dig into some of those. So a few episodes back, we talked about there's a circle of prophets in the Anabaptist community in Strasbourg. And Strasbourg is where Bernard Rothman went, one of the cities that he visited on his Reformation tour in 1531. And he connected with Caspar Schwenkfeld, Martin Bucer, and learned about the way that they were leading churches. What did it look like to lead in these different contexts? Strasbourg is also the city where Melchior Hoffman was imprisoned. That's where he predicted the Lord would return in 1533. And that's where he was identified as the new Elijah, one of the last two witnesses of the end times. And that pronouncement was made by this circle of Anabaptist prophets, which included at least two very prominent women. The first one is named Ursula Jost. She and her husband, who was a butcher, both received visions about the end of all things. Mm. A book of her prophetic visions was published and distributed. And when Melchior Hoffman arrived in Strasbourg the first time, he was just a regular church reformer who didn't like Martin Luther, but after his time with Ursula Jost and her husband, he was ready to embrace Anabaptism. So none of this happens without the role of female prophets.
Wow. I'd be interested in seeing what this Ursula's book looked like.
It was distributed. It was relatively rare for a woman's words to be published, so that's already an accomplishment. Strasbourg was on the leading edge of some church reform things, and so there was room for Anabaptists to have a voice, and even Anabaptist women. And the second prominent woman in the Anabaptist circle of prophets was named Barbara Rebstock. She had traveled outside of Strasbourg to learn from church leaders in different places. And people outside of the city of Strasbourg would come from long distances to hear her. She had established a reputation as a person who had visions, not just about Strasbourg, but about the church and the whole world. And they would come to her home. They would come to the meeting places where they worshipped, and she would prophesy.
What does that mean, though? Talk about like what she thought was going to happen in the future, or talk about like a spiritual prophecy or something that was going to happen in real life?
Yeah, so she would talk about the dreams that she had, and then she would explain what they meant. So there's a little bit of a example of that that I would like you to read, and then we can discuss that.
Yeah, sure.
Obie Phillips, we talked about him a little while ago. He recorded some of the things that he had seen and heard from this circle of prophets, and he explains how Barbara Rebstock had a vision that identified Melchior Hoffman as the new Elijah. Mm-hmm. So I would like you to read this portion right here.
Mm. She saw a white swan swimming in a beautiful river or watercourse, which swan had sung beautifully and wonderfully. And that she interpreted to apply to Melchior as the true Elijah. Mm. Can I read the rest?
Okay. Yeah, please read the rest.
And that she interpreted to apply to Melchior as the true Elijah. She had also seen a vision of many death heads on the walls around Strasbourg. When she wondered whether Melchior's head was among them, and she tried to see, she became aware of Melchior's head, and as she gazed upon it, the head laughed and looked at her in a friendly way. Thereafter, she saw that all the other heads came alive, one after the other, and they all began to laugh. Oh, dear.
So if you or I had the same dream, we might not interpret it the same way.
Yeah, I wonder if people are taking themselves a little too seriously back in the 1500s.
Right. So that's part of the challenge is we have these historical figures, male or female, who would be very strange if we came across them today. But they play important roles in this story and the whole Anabaptist movement. All right, we talked about Klaus Frey is the guy who turned in Melchior Hoffman, reported him to the authorities in Strasbourg. He was the guy that left Strasbourg and his unsupportive wife and then moved to a new community, found a more enthusiastic and supportive wife. They moved back to Strasbourg, and it was Barbara Rebstock who told him that he should go back to his first wife.
Oh, and what did he do?
He didn't like it, and so that's when he decided to turn Melchior Hoffman into the authorities.
Oh, wow.
So women play a big part in this story, in Munster in particular, but mostly behind the scenes. So many of the native Munsterites who stayed when everybody else left were women. And whether or not they supported Jan Matthys or Jan van Leyden afterwards, it was their home. Their children were often there. And so they were in the city, and they would do what they could to ensure that their children were safe and that their property was safe. As things changed, they shut down the monasteries and the convents. And so the women who were living there as nuns were released. But many of them hadn't enrolled in monasteries out of a free choice. They had done so because they had been cast out by their families. Mm. So many of them became enthusiastic supporters of the Anabaptist movement.
Wow, that's interesting.
And Munster offered something new, something that other cities, whether they were Catholic or Lutheran, weren't really doing. And when something new and dramatic happens, as we see in religious movements today still, they're especially appealing to people on the fringes of society.
Right.
Many of whom are often women for a variety of reasons. So by the time that the siege begins, by the time Jan Matthys is killed, there are roughly 3 adult women in Munster for every adult man.
Oh, wow.
They are by far the majority of people in the community. So one of the Dutch women that arrived, so she wasn't from Munster originally, was a woman by the name of Hyla Fiken. Now, I'm guessing on that pronunciation, but she was from the community of Snake in Friesland.
Right.
Anyways, she arrived in Munster and immediately moved into one of the abandoned monasteries because that's...
Oh, wow. Good idea.
Yeah, so they had been made available. There was a real kind of a community of goods feeling. Mm. So that's why people like Hyla Fiken, who had been cast out from their communities, who were poor, or who had just had a new and different religious awakening, they were drawn to Munster, and that's kind of what brought her there. And later on, she would talk about how her husband had introduced her to Anabaptist ideas, but she came to Munster by herself.
Okay.
Now, the other question is, are you aware of the biblical story of Judith?
Didn't give him milk and put a peg through his head, that one?
So, okay, so the woman you're thinking of is Yael, one of the feminist heroes of the Bible, who drove a tent peg through the military general's head. This is a similar story, but it's from the book of Judith.
Okay.
And you might not recognize that as a book title.
Okay.
Because it is a deuterocanonical book.
Oh.
That's a funny word. It's in the Apocrypha.
Which is Catholic.
It's Catholic now, but but those divisions hadn't really happened at this point.
Wow.
The early Anabaptists loved the Apocrypha. And there were stories in the Apocrypha that they leaned on, including the story of Judith.
Oh, dear. Okay.
So I'm going to give you a reading, but first I'm going to explain.
Yeah.
So Judith was a widow, and she lived in a Jewish city that was surrounded by Assyrian soldiers. Mm-hmm. Her husband had died. She was wearing mourning clothing. And after a while, she had an inspiration that she needed to do something about this army that had laid siege to their city. So she took off her mourning clothes, M-O-U-R, mourning clothes, and she put on her best clothes, some of her best jewelry, and she had brought her servant with her, and she had kind of run some of this by the Jewish leadership of her city. But they let her out of the city gates, and she arrived and explained to the soldiers that she had information that the that the military commander needed to hear.
Okay.
The commander's name was Holofernes. And they said, yeah, okay, we'll bring you. It also helped, according to the biblical story, that she was stunningly gorgeous.
Mm.
That's my translation. Anyways, they bring her to the general. And he, of course, is captivated by her beauty and wants to hear her explanation. And she gives them a long story of how her people have been following bad leadership, but under him, that everything would be better. He's so happy to hear this. They throw a huge party that lasts all day. So at the end of the day, she goes with him to his tent. And the story continues. And this is Judith chapter 13. So I just want you to read the first two verses here.
When evening came, his slaves left quickly. And Bagoas closed up the tent from the outside and shut out those who had been waiting on his master. They all went to bed, for they were exhausted because the party had lasted a long time. Judith was left alone in the tent with Holofernes sprawled out on his bed, dead drunk.
Right. So, Holofernes.
We're here at Menards Bank Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies. Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details. Save big money
at has plans with Judith, but he's unable to fulfill what he wants to do, which was part of her plan to make him think that this was possible. All right, so we'll skip over a few verses, and then if you can just start there in the middle of verse 4.
Then Judith stood next to his bed and said in her heart, Lord God of all power, look at this hour upon the work of my hands for the glory of Jerusalem. Now is the time to help your inheritance and to accomplish my plans to destroy the enemies who have risen up against us. Then she went to the bedpost near Holofernes' head and took down his sword. When she came closer to the bed, she grabbed his hair on his head and said, Give me strength today, Lord, God of Israel. She struck him in the neck twice with all her might and cut off his head.
So this story of Judith is new to us,
mm-hmm.
but it's not new to the artistic community. There are a number of paintings of it in fairly graphic detail.
Interesting.
But have you heard of the painter Gustav Klimt?
I have indeed, yes.
All right, so I'm going to show you a picture.
Okay, sure.
Tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, have you seen this before?
Oh, wow, yeah, I've seen this many times. I didn't realize this was Judith. What does it say at the top? Judith. Oh, it does say Judith on there.
Yeah, wow. Judith and Holofernes.
Yeah, and there she is holding his head, which I've also somehow never noticed.
Right. So that's what makes this depiction of this story different from other artists who make it clear what's happening.
Mm.
But in this picture,
mm-hmm.
It's not clear that the head she's holding is not attached to a body.
Yeah, that's fantastic. She's looks really proud of herself and elated and filled with the Holy Ghost, I guess.
Right. And she's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And confident.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a regalness to this. Lots of gold work built into it.
Yeah, that's actually a really beautiful painting.
So anyways, I'll add that to the YouTube video.
Mm-hmm.
So the listeners and viewers can see it. But yeah, it's a new story to us, but not to the artistic community.
Thanks for sharing that.
So there seems to be parallels in this situation and the Munster story, which haven't escaped us, and they certainly did not escape Hyla Fikin's reading of the situation. So she saw the biblical story of Judith as exemplary. Judith was a hero, a heroine for her. So she came up with the idea that she was going to do the same thing. She talked to Jan van Leyden and some of the other leaders, and they prayed about it, and they said, yeah, go ahead. So she went out there and was immediately arrested. She didn't have nearly the success that Judith did. And they had all sorts of questions for her. So they asked, like, who deceived you? Who tricked you into becoming an Anabaptist? Well, she said, it was my husband. Okay, well, who is your husband? Right, we'll go arrest and torture your husband. And so she said her husband's name was Salmus, P-S-A-L-M-U-S. That's not a name. And nobody in that area was named Salmus. So is that a kind of a nickname that she had for her husband? A nickname within the community? There are some scholars who suspect that Salmus, which begins with the letters P and S, was sort of her abbreviation for her husband, whose name was Peter Simons, who we suspect was the brother of Menno Simons, who was kind of later became the leader of the Dutch Anabaptist movement, which is then became the Mennonite movement. And Peter Simons died in Olde Klooster, a monastery back in Friesland, that was taken over by people sympathetic to the Munster movement. So there are some cross ties there, some interesting connections. But they weren't satisfied by the information they got from Hyla Fyken, and she was executed. And Bishop Franz von Waldeck didn't throw a party for her, didn't take her to his tent, and was not decapitated by her.
Well, maybe she wasn't hot enough.
Maybe that's part of it. But you kind of have to wonder about the mindset of a person who reads this story and says, oh, I could do that.
Well, optimism.
Or maybe that's the only power she thought she as a woman had in this community.
Maybe it's just
community.
Faith.
Maybe it's just faith. Maybe all of this is just faith.
Yeah.
One of the women that arrived with Jan Matthys when he came to Munster the first time was his wife, Divara. That's her name. And she was also famously beautiful. That seems to be... No, we don't know how good-looking any of the men are. Although some of the reproductions that we have don't convince contemporary eyes that she was beautiful. That's maybe a product of the historian's work as well. And so when Jan Matthys dies, that's her husband, then she's appropriately mournful. But very soon after that, Jan van Leyden, who's kind of the heir apparent, seems to be everybody's choice to be the new leader, he has a vision that says he's supposed to marry Divara, and then she becomes his queen. Jan Matthys wasn't the king, but somehow through a series of prophetic visions, Jan van Leyden becomes the king and Divara becomes his queen.
In their minds, though, this isn't...
They declare themselves to be king and queen.
This happened.
Yeah.
So she said yes to marrying him.
Well, that's the thing. We don't know if this was a love match. We don't know how much agency she had. But yes, she agreed to marry him. Around the same time, Easter 1534 is when Jan Matthys dies. In July of the same year, Jan Matthys marries Divara, but also they declare that now polygamy is legal. And not just legal, but mandated.
So things have taken a really big leap.
A big leap, yeah.
What? How? Like, why?
So
so many women.
Right. So part of it is there's this huge numerical discrepancy. But there is a community of goods. They are feeding each other. But the food rations are distributed among the men.
Oh, my goodness.
So one way of assuring that all of the people, all of the women get food, is to make sure that they're attached to men who are distributing the food.
Okay, but this is true patriarchy here right now. Delivering the food as men and then the women just sort it out. If you want to survive, hook yourself up to a man because you're not going to get food any other way.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that's pretty sick.
Yeah, so this has been used ever since as a way of discrediting the movement by people on both sides, right? So people say, well, this is patriarchy and it's disgusting. Other people who are big fans of patriarchy have also said, well, polygamy is clearly against biblical teachings.
Interesting.
Right. So on both sides, this is evidence against Jan van Leyden's credibility as a leader.
Wow.
But Jan van Leyden had 16 wives.
Okay, so when did he have 16 wives? After he declared it was okay in July or before that?
After.
So he in July, he got an extra 15 wives?
Right. So he couldn't have before that, because there had been a declaration of what holy living would look like in Munster, right? So men could only be with their wives, as according to that dictate, but then they had to loosen it so that there could be more wives.
Got that.
Yeah.
Like, did he have a lot of money?
He had all the money, right? He was the king, right? He had the best clothes. He had access to the best property.
But it wasn't a king. It wasn't like a country where there was a king and queen before. So they just turned themselves into a king and queen. So that must have been a kind of a hard system to make the finances go. Like, it wasn't a monarchy. It wasn't a, whatever. What's it called? That's the right word.
Yeah. So within the walls, you can set your own rules, right? Nobody outside of Munster recognized him as the king, right? But ever since then, wow, since he declared it,
yeah,
that's wow, that's how he's addressed.
Yeah, funny.
And not just king of Munster, but Munster is where Jesus was coming back to save the whole world. So by being king of Munster, Jan van Leyden was king of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of ego at play here.
Yeah. Wow.
So one of Jan's other wives, he had 16 wives, and many of these women were connected to other powerful families in Munster. So it was also a way of legitimizing his rule because he was connected now to all these different families. But one of his wives was a woman by the name of Elizabeth Wandshearer. I don't know where the name comes from. And according to the story, she looks at the situation and she sees how she is living comfortably. She and the other wives have access to more food, better clothes. But the longer the siege takes, the harder it is to get food into the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty soon there isn't enough food for everybody, which we'll talk about next week. But King Jan and the royal household has not just food, but good food. And she sees a disconnect between what they all are supposed to believe and what she's experiencing. So she goes to Jan.
What's her name?
Elizabeth Wandshearer.
Right, okay.
So Elizabeth goes to her husband. She takes her jewelry, some of the fine stuff she's been given. She lays it in front of him and says, I can't live this way anymore. So I'm giving it all back to you, and with your permission, I would like to leave. He doesn't take this very well.
Okay.
And she's killed by him on the spot.
What?
And the other 15 wives, according to the story, and there's reason to question this, which we'll talk about later again too. The other 15 wives immediately start singing songs of praise to God for the justice that has been administered in front of them.
Okay. I thought these guys were like peace lovers.
They may have been before the siege, but when you're surrounded by an army, it's pretty hard to hold on to pacifist ideals.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
Until now, it's been a series of theological developments with political underpinnings. But now we're starting to see some of the ugly social realities that aren't surviving the theological filters that they all claim to have been put in place.
Yeah, wow. It's turning into like a cult or something.
Right. Yeah, all of the earmarks of a cult that we would be looking for now are clearly on display in terms of the charismatic leadership, both of Jan Matthys and Jan van Leyden, the limited freedom of people within the movement to speak up their dissent, the subjugation of women to the whims of the leaders. All of these things are happening in what was supposed to be this utopian paradise to which Jesus would return.
Wow. That's crazy.
All right. And I think that's where we'll leave it for this week. And we'll get back to the theology and the politics and the military in the next episode. But now we've gotten a little bit of a window into the personal and social realities of what was happening in Munster.
Wow. Well, that was great. I have to say thank you so much, Will, for just taking the time to just have a moment just focusing on the women and their part of the story. I always find stories so much more interesting from a female perspective. And obviously, it's really taken a turn with the number of women involved in the marriages and the number of women involved in this town. I wonder if maybe survival was their motivation. I don't know. But yeah, thanks a lot for sharing that. It was really interesting.
Yeah, well, I thought it was important. It's easy to look at this as a historical event, a trajectory of theological ideas. But the story of the women, I think, kind of hits home the power of how these ideas, some of which I think are good ideas but poorly implemented, impact a lot of vulnerable people, especially the women.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Robin, for listening and following along. Thanks to you, too, the listener, for engaging. I'm going to put up some pictures connected to this story on the website and in the YouTube video that you can follow on the YouTube channel. We are available on podcast platforms. We would love it if you would share with your friends, people who you think might be interested, and join us again in a few weeks for the next episode. Thanks for following.
Yeah, I can't wait to find out what happens. Bye.